That geographical factor important. Here's a map, and with Iran shown in this yellow color here. It's sandwiched between Iraq and Afghanistan, two countries that have been in the news for a couple of decades here now because of the long-running wars that we were involved in there. Iran is overwhelmingly Muslim, 98-99% Muslim. However, its 90 million citizens are not Arabs. We tend to equate all Muslims are Arabs and all Arabs are Muslims. That's not necessarily the case. Nearly all Muslims are Arabs, but not all Muslims are Nearly all Arabs are Muslim, but not all Muslims are Arabs. The Iranians are ethnically Persian for the most part, which is very distinct. Turkey is another overwhelmingly Muslim people, but its people are not Arabs. They're from different areas, different ethnic groups. Malaysia, India, Pakistan, those have very huge Muslim populations, but they are not Arabs. So even though the Arab world is nearly all Muslim, not all Muslims are Arabs. So we do need to understand that factor there. Like many of the nations in this area, Iran is a major oil-producing nation, sells most of its oil to China, which is a huge international player right now. It also occupies, if you can see on this, the small body of water labeled the Persian Gulf, just below Iran. That's very much in the news right now because Iran has basically closed the Persian Gulf to oil tankers. About 30% of the world's oil production goes through the Persian Gulf and out to the rest of the world. And that is bottled up right now. And that is the primary reason why we've seen such a huge spike in gasoline and diesel prices right now, is because that oil supply is choked off, and it's a simple matter of supply and demand. If the supply isn't going through, if supply is choked off, the price of the goods goes up. So that's why gas prices have skyrocketed, and unfortunately those prices aren't going to come down until that situation gets resolved or other supplies start coming online. Let's talk a little bit about history. This seems like a very sudden war, but it did not start 3 weeks ago. It did not start 3 months ago, or 3 years ago, or three decades ago. It actually started in its current phase. Thank you.
the enrichment for civilian nuclear energy production is 320% more charge. Depending on the design of the nuclear reactor, 320% daily enrichment is 60%. 60% enriched uranium is too hot to run any civilian nuclear reactor. It's only good for one thing, and it's nuclear weapons. It's the only thing you can use that kind of uranium for. So we covered some of the history of the big attacks on the United States. What about Israel? Why did Israel join in with these attacks with the U.S. military? Let's go through some history here. More than 30 years ago, 1992, the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires, Argentina, was hit with a bomb that killed 40 people and injured 240. 2 years later, also in Buenos Aires, 1994, a Jewish community center was bombed. 85 people were killed and more than 300 injured. And these attacks were traced back to Iranian agents. Iranians also funded and supported various Middle Eastern terror groups whose hostility has been directed toward Israel for decades now. One of the largest is Hezbollah in Lebanon. We see in the news constant reports of Hezbollah launching rockets like these. This is a photo of the Hezbollah terrorists there in Lebanon. In 2006, there was a significant war where Hezbollah had been sponsoring so many terrorist attacks, launching so many missiles and bombs and mortars and so on into Israel, that Israel invaded. There was a considerable war there that cost the lives of 163 Israelis. And more than 2,500 Israeli soldiers and civilians were wounded and maimed in that war. Iran has also supported the war in the war 2.5 years ago, I mentioned, between Hamas. Terrorists invaded Israel. And in those attacks again, roughly 1,200 Israelis were killed and 251 taken hostage. As a percentage of population, that would be the equivalent of an attack that killed 40,000 Americans. So if you wonder why that was such a huge deal in Israel, it would be what an attack in the United States would have been wiped out. The population of a small city, 40,000 Americans, would be the equivalent of that. And now, since then, Iran has launched many drone strikes and missile strikes against Israel, which have taken place virtually daily. One just struck near the Temple Mount, within about 400 yards of the Temple Mount, just yesterday. Part of it was intercepted by an Israeli missile in the air. Part of the missile hit, and you can find videos of it on YouTube. It's been tracking. They have continued to launch drone strikes, missile strikes, and so on. And as a result of that, Israel has been forced into another invasion of southern Lebanon. They've been spreading and penetrating further into Lebanon to try to take out these missile and drone launch strikes. This will show you where they're coming from. This is the flag from Hezbollah. The original flag, and you can see the arm holding the AK-47 assault rifle there. And the wording at the top and the bottom of this says, Hezbollah are the victors. Hezbollah are the victors. Hezbollah, incidentally, is two words, Hez and Allah. Allah being the God of Islam, so it means the party or the group of Allah. That's what Hezbollah means. You will find that mentioned there in the media. So this is a pretty thorough background as to what Iran has been doing against the United States and Israel for the last 47 years. But the bigger question is why? Why have they done this? Why has there been this constant hostility, this constant attacks, terrorism, terror attacks, other things? And one of the clear I'm talking not about the Iranian people, because the Iranian people have several of them over the years. I think they're mostly very, very friendly, very pro-Western, very industrious people. And after the, I don't recall what I mentioned, it's about me, after the Iranian Revolution, many Iranians fled the country to the United States. And I met several of them, and I've been impressed with them quite a bit. So I want to clear here that what I'm talking about is the Iranian government and its policies and what motivates and drives them. So it is the government that is behind the problem, and why is it that motivates them for this constant terrorism against the United States and Israel? So again, it goes back to the Shah of Iran, who ruled from 1941 to 1979. And there's a photo of the Shah with President and Iranian Muslim Carter, and the Shah and his wife there. And the Shah was very Western oriented. He produced his country produced a lot of oil, which they sold to Western nations. And they were really the greatest allies of the Western world there, in the middle of the Muslim Arab world. But that changed in 79 with the Islamic Revolution. And that revolution was led by this man, Ayatollah Khomeini. And this again led directly to the taking of the American embassy there, and the policy of being held for 444 days. And that was one of the most humiliating events in all of American history. Because embassy personnel, embassies are considered the sovereign territory of the nation. So that was viewed as American territory. That's why all embassies were wide or viewed as a territory of the nation that is sponsoring them. So that was an attack on American territory that took all of these individuals hostage for almost a year and a half. So Ayatollah Khomeini was about as nice as it looks in this photo. He was an extreme Islamic hardliner. To gain power, he assembled a coalition of fundamentalist Muslims and leftist-leaning liberals who were opposed to the Shah. And once the Shah fled the country, as his government was falling, the fundamentalist Muslims turned on the liberal citizens of Iran and started jailing and executing them. And as a result of that, again, thousands and thousands of Iranians fled the country, fled to the West, and they have been settled here in the United States. And they do, if you meet any of them and have a conversation with them, they'll almost inevitably, they won't say they're Iranian, they will say they're Persian, because they don't want to be identified with the current government. research on it. Anybody know what this is? It's a flag in Saudi Arabia. What is the word in Arabic say? It's written in Arabic script. And it says, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. And most of you have not get the point, because it's order to illustrate that this is our belief, and you accept this on your face this morning. Pretty proud, but that's the way it is. Now, this is Saudi Arabia. This is not Iran. Saudi Arabia is the birthplace of Islam and Muhammad. So it shows the thinking right where and how it originated. Let's look at another couple of verses from the Quran. Chapter 9, verse 5 says, when the sacred months are over, slay the idolaters, non-Muslims, wherever you find them. Arrest them, besiege them, and lie in ambush everywhere for them. Again, idolaters, Christians, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, anybody who is not a Muslim, you're told in Islam's holy book to slay them wherever you find them. And there was also the mythics that are used. This is bluntly advocating terrorism. Like an ambush for non-Muslims to kill them, to fight dirty, to not fight them out in the open, but to lie in ambush for them. So acts of terrorism are perfectly fine. And they're holy book, that's why they practice it so often as they do. This reminds me of a passage, coming up on the Syria, the Exodus, and Passover at that time of the year, and it reminds me how. You remember the story as the Israelites are leaving Egypt, they wander in the wilderness for 40 years, and there's one group of people who practice an early form of terrorism. They attack the leader of the Israelite column as they're traveling. Who was it, the leader? It was the weakest part of the people. They put their fighting men out in front in case you encounter the enemy. But the leader of the column would be the elderly, the sick, the children, the weak, the most vulnerable of the people, and the Israelites ambushed and attacked the leader. The Israelite people said during their journeys there, and God's judgment was to wipe them out. I will wipe them totally. That's what Saul was told to do, and he disobeyed. And God removed his kingdom. But that same mentality has existed in that part of the world for about 3,500 years now. To fight dirty, to practice terrorism against their enemies. So another verse from the Quran, chapter 5, verses 34 and 35. Those that make war against Allah and his apostle, Muhammad, and spread disorder in the land shall be slain or crucified, and have their hands and feet cut off on alternate sides, will be banished from the land, and shall be held up to shame in this world, and shall be punished in the hereafter. So here we see in the Holy Book that Allah commands the torture, the crippling, the maiming of prisoners. And crucifixion, of course, is a horrible form of torture and execution. This is cutting off someone's hand or foot on opposite sides. And a decade or two ago, when there were so many beheading videos and so on that we saw on the news, what wasn't shown was this being practiced as well. And some of those beheading videos, I didn't mean to do this, but both of your commands in the Quran to be attitudes to planted his work at, quoted from the Quran, from the Holy Book, and I'll show you in here as well. See him afterwards. So, how did I get this book to the background story? When 9/11 happened, 2001, when I get hits, you want to take down the World Trade Center, I was at the middle of nowhere in Alaska for nothing really embarrassing. That's why I moved on. But I was in the middle of nowhere. It's a 30-mile boat ride or floatplane flight to get to this location. It's a national park in it. And in the middle of nowhere, when I was up there, when those attacks took place, and we were very isolated. They shut down all of air traffic across the nation at that time. So nobody's getting in or out of this location. And there was a ranger station, sort of a nudge away to monitor things. And they did have some satellite internet access, so I was able to go there and find out what was going on to the extent that I could. But after I got back home, it took several days before they resumed flights, and I was finally able to get back to civilization. But as soon as I got home, well, the first thing that I did was to order this very copy of the program that I ordered at that time, because I wanted to understand what was going on. Why would these countries, these people, expect us in this way? Because I always heard that Islam is in a land of peace. You probably heard Islam means peace. No, it doesn't. Islam means submission. Submission to what? Submission to Allah and His Word. And the right of Islam does not mean peace at all. But everything that I had heard or read for decades about Islam, I learned was a lie. And I bought a number of books on the history of Islam. I read countless magazine articles, historical articles about its history, and so on. And realized that the opposite was true. Islam is not a religion of peace. It's a religion of submission. And as I was saying, from these quotes, their own holy book tells them to kill or forcibly convert those who are not Muslim. So, again, I want to make clear, I'm talking about not the people, not all Muslims as a whole. Many Muslims, and I traveled to Egypt, to Jordan, to Turkey, to Israel, and many of them, most of them, are very friendly, very hospitable. Of course, they want their money, so that the income relations are going to treat them nicely, but their holy book is higher than my policy. I'll just get a handful of quotations from there today to illustrate my point. So, the Muslims who do support terrorism, who support terror groups like Hamas and Hezbollah and the Muslim Brotherhood and so on, they're simply doing what their holy book tells them to do, which is to fight the infidels until Islam reigns supreme throughout the world. So, another primary teaching of Islamic theology is that the world is divided into two spheres, two areas of influence, you might say. And in Arabic, they're called Dar al-Islam, which is the land or the abode of Islam, and Dar al-Harb, which is the land or the abode of the unbeliever, or it can be translated the land of war. And what does that mean? Well, the fundamental aspect of Islamic teaching is that all non-Muslim lands must eventually be conquered by Islam. We just read this in verses earlier. Fight against them, non-Muslims, until idolatry is no more and Allah's religion reigns supreme. That is, you might say, the first and biggest commandment of the Quran to take over the world. So the entire world is under Islam. So, fundamental to this Muslim countries among themselves are generally at peace. However, just in the last few months, there's, you know, let's say, civil wars in Syria and in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. Wars between these three countries where you have more hardline Muslims, the Taliban, who want to overthrow them. Thinking that Bar al-Islam and Bar al-Haram is why there is so much long-standing hostility toward Israel from the Muslim world. Because it is considered an abomination, you might say, for a land that was once under the control of Islam, and the Holy Land was under control of the Muslims from around 700 AD. So it's considered an abomination for a land that was once owned and controlled by Muslims to come under Christian or Jewish control. Incidentally, the same thing could be said of Spain and Portugal because they were under Islamic control for a number of centuries in parts of Eastern Europe. So it is the goal of the Muslims to reconquer those lands. So that is why there's been so much hostility toward Israel in particular, and why Muslim leaders over years have repeatedly urged Muslims to unite and drive the infidels out of these Muslim worlds, Muslim lands. It also explains why there's incessant wars around the fringes of the Muslim world. You might think of the fights wars, but there were definite attacks, military attacks between Pakistan and India, Pakistan being Muslim, India being Hindu, Africa. We read just about every week of churches being burned, Christian churches being burned, Christians slaughtered, Christian schoolgirls being taken hostage. All of this is complicated by the fact that approximately one in four people in the world is Muslim. About one in four, approximately 2 million Muslims. Also, Muslim nations are about one in four nations, roughly 50 out of about 200 nations in the world are predominantly Muslims. About one fourth of the population, about one fourth of all nations. Controls an awful lot of the oil, the economic lifeblood of the world, so they have an enormous amount of clout when it comes to power and governments and how the government policies affect the rest of the world. An enormous amount of clout at the United Nations, and then it's a national organization. So, in the long run, where all of this is leading is this is not going to stop. What happens in Iran right now, or next week, or next month, or next year, this is not going to stop because it's all driven by what they need in their holy book. there are two other quotes from the meeting. And yours is just from Kennedy, that's John Lewis, the Iranian president and commander-in-chief from 1989 to 1997. In 2001, he openly threatened the mission to Berlin. But it did say that usually when one nuclear bomb inside Israel will destroy everything. It's not irrational to contemplate such an eventuality. Now, what do you mean by that? Well, if you've ever been to Israel, or a day like that, Israel's a tiny country. You could fit five or six Israels in the state of Colorado. Israel's only about 300 miles north of south, and average is about 40 miles wide. About 60% of the population of Iraq. roughly 12 people. Here's where it gets weird. A ton of people Medicare. The brain is called Elon, was born in 1868-69, so well over 1,200 years ago, and they disappeared about age 5 or 6 as a fairly young boy. And it just disappeared from public view. But I believe he's still alive today. But he believed he was being hidden from public view, but when the time was right for Islam to conquer the world, he would emerge and emerge out of hiding. And for that reason, he is sometimes referred to as, quote, the hidden imam. That's another term for this individual. The hidden imam or the twelfth imam. These 12 years and much of Shiite Islam believe that this hidden imam, this 12th imam, is to be the prophesied Balaam Mahdi, Mahdi, M-A-H-D-I. And it usually means we would refer to as Messiah. They believe that he was chosen by Allah to lead Islam to its rightful place. The dominant religion of the world, and the only religion of the entire world. So, Shiite Muslims, all the ones that I've talked to and quoted from here, believe that this Mahdi will return during a time of worldwide chaos to establish a worldwide Islamic rulership of peace and and righteousness with everyone converting or converted to Islam and living under the laws of the Quran. It's an obvious sense of a counterfeit on what Jesus Christ is going to do. He will return in the time of worldwide chaos and establish the reign of the kingdom of God on earth. So it's a satanic counterfeit there. However, in their belief, this 12th imam, Jesus Christ, will accompany them, not as Christian, but as a Muslim. And he will be essentially the 12th imam's enforcer, who will force the world to convert to Islam or die. So, yeah, it's an obligation to counterfeit. But millions and millions of Muslims believe this, including the majority of the population of Iran and all of their leadership that I'm quoting from. So these are the beliefs that have driven Iran's leadership for the last 47 years since the revolution. Now, this is not too crazy, which is like I'm crazy. Let me give you some quotes to back up what I'm going to say. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, recent president of Iran, gave an address to the United Nations. Every year they had world leaders address the entire body of the UN there. That's what they published in New York. What did he choose to say? In the name of God, probably Allah, probably the word they used, the compassionate, the merciful, praise be to Allah, the Lord of the universe. And peace and blessings be upon our Master and Prophet Muhammad. But that's not all, he said, continuing. He said, O God, probably Allah, hasten the arrival of Imam Mahdi, the Mahdi, the Islamic Messiah. Hasten the arrival of our Messiah, and grant him good health and victory. And make us his followers and those who attest to his rightfulness. So he's telling the whole world to pray for the arrival of the Islamic Messiah. Another teaching of Islam is that if you're Muslim and you're about to go to war against the non-Muslims, you have is to first invite them to convert to Islam, convert peacefully, or we'll fight you and kill you. That's the bottom line. Martin Luther King God did exactly this in this address to the United Nations, quoting from him. We emphasize that the only path to remain safe remains safe from what? From danger, which is what we want to do to enjoy. We emphasize that the only path to remain safe is to return to monotheism, and Islam, that means worship of the one true God, Allah, and justice. And this is the greatest hope and opportunity in all ages and generations. So, that is another. This is how he concluded his speech. Actually, one more quote containing with that. Without belief in Allah and commitment to the cause of justice and fight against injustice and discrimination, the world structure cannot be put right. And then he concluded the speech with this. There will come a time when justice will prevail across the globe under the rule of the perfect man, the last divine source on earth, the good. Saying is the only way the world will see peace is when the Islamic Messiah emerges and forces all the world to convert to Islam. This is not the first or the only time he said that. He said it in other UN speeches, which we'll take the time to go through. So, the bottom line is that the Iranian leaders for the last 47 years have consistently been driven by their belief that their Islamic Messiah is going to appear soon, and that they can hasten that day, by launching wars leading to global chaos to create the conditions for their Mahdi to appear. And that's why, for decades, they have sponsored groups, terror groups like Hamas and Hezbollah, and Muslim Brotherhood, and Islamic Jihad, and the Houthis, and Yemen, and the Roman Revolutionary Guards. And also, what makes it worse, they don't believe in passively sitting back and waiting for this to happen. They believe they actually have an obligation to speed up this process. And regardless of what the cost them personally or what cost their nation. And this has been their powerful motivation in pursuing nuclear weapons, because what is a greater factor to create global chaos than settling into nuclear warheads to various capitals around the world? Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Berlin, Rome, Paris, London, places like that. What could bring the terror of global chaos faster than launching a dozen nukes all across the world capitals? This is also why they trip back to America, back to Israel, back to Britain. Because of those other ways they will create a kind of worldwide chaos. It's also crucial to understand that most Muslims, not just the ones we've talked about, expect this Islamic Messiah, Mahdi, to arise in time. This Mahdi will be, again, in Muslim belief, a Messiah-like person who will rise and lead Muslim forces to unite and take over the entire world. And in Islamic history, this has actually happened about a dozen times. This is not just theoretical. This is real. It's happened. It's happened in recent years. Here are two individuals who rose in the 1880s, one in Sudan, which is south of Egypt, and the other in India. Any of you ever seen the movie Khartoum? It was filmed up in the 60s, I believe. And it was about this Messiah. It was about the one in Egypt, Sudan, who rose up to try to take the British out of Sudan. hope succeeded. So he moved on, the one in India, these were two of them successful, but almost succeeded in driving the British out. More recent times, 1979, there was an individual who proclaimed himself the Mahdi and tried to take over the Great Mosque, which is shown here in Mecca, in Saudi Arabia. And it led to a very bloody gun battle in which 300 people were killed there. And all of his followers were rounded up and beheaded by the Saudis. It had been a total kind of nonsense. You might also remember that during the Iraq War, not that long ago, one of the largest opposition groups of military thought was called the Mahdi Army. Because of the belief in becoming of this body. This was our hope to deliver themselves. So this belief in an entire body is a very real thing that happened again about a dozen times in Islamic history. That this individual will arise at a time of turmoil and chaos and warfare and will throw the farmers out of their lands and will ultimately lead to the Muslim movement to take over the entire world. But those on the internet, I can't prove it, but I think that it's probably the entire kingdom itself will be. It was described in Daniel 11, that he will come and be this Mahdi, and Muslim to the heart of the Islamic lands, who will probably end up gaining several hundred million Muslim followers. So, what does this mean for all of us in the short term? In the short term, it looks like Iran is considered nuclear arms and spender for the next decade or so. It's time for regional power. Iran is probably the strongest military, or was, until 3 weeks ago, the strongest military in that part of the world. But the reality is that for centuries, these four powers in yellow here, Turkey, Iran, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, have been kind of jockeying for the position of power as to who is going to be ruler over the entirety of the Islamic world. We've got 50 nations and a quarter of the Earth's population. And they each believe that they deserve to be the leader for different reasons. Iran, because historically, it was the homeland of the Persian Empire, one of the greatest empires in the ancient world. Turkey, because it was the homeland of the Ottoman Empire, which ruled the Middle East for centuries. Saudi Arabia, because it was the home of Muhammad and the birthplace of Islam, and the home of Mecca and Medina, the two holy cities of Islam, and Egypt, which is the most powerful Muslim military in the world. So just because Iran is being taken down right now, and that will greatly diminish the amount of bloodshed and death of the terror groups they've supported for decades now. But that doesn't mean that the underlying goal of Islam that occurred today is disappearing. It doesn't mean that Muslims don't want to recapture the land from Israel and Portugal and Spain and other parts of Europe. It doesn't mean that they're resentful that the power of the Western nations is diminished. And it doesn't mean that peace will prevail in the Middle East at any time soon. Because of these other powers are still jockeying to take over and run the Islamic world. So, in summary, I hope this helps give you some of the insight that we need to understand the dangerous, the volatile geopolitics of this region of the world. If you don't understand the things I've talked about today, if it seems like it's sheer madness, it's sheer craziness that's driving these people, but it's not. It's a set of very firm religious beliefs that have been around for centuries, and they're acting on those beliefs.